Chapter 9. The Beheading. Long before dawn, Abdullah Asanwar rose from his bed in an unlit cell. There were grander apartments in the silent mansions, but Anwar eschewed them. The terrible losses the beast had inflicted had impelled him towards humility. All astropaths were blind, but very few of them were sightless. Some pieced together a patchwork world gathered from foreseen events, apprehending their surroundings through anticipation. The more powerful might see through the eyes of other people. Some saw the world as a blinding vista of soul light. A few sensed the echoes of a past that wove themselves psychically into the fabric of the universe. Theirs was a sad fate, constantly subjected to the ghostly replays of emotional events, many of great horror. As the head of the Adeptus Astra Telepathica, Abdullah Asanwar was a telepath of extraordinary ability. The human mind was an open book to him, if it were not carefully warded. His world was one of phantom shapes, a vision of sorts that wove the souls of living beings into a map of energy. It had been so long since Anwar had seen a face, the memory had faded into the depths of his extraordinarily long life. Physical beauty was meaningless to him. What he did see was spiritual beauty. The souls of the living shone. Each person was a network of fibers, alive with a pulse of thought. The souls of good men were white, those of less noble tendency, red. Blue indicated great sorrow, those burdened with their duties showed a dull yellow, and so on in a million hues. No man or woman was a single shade, save a rare few. Most were subtle blendings that changed from moment to moment. From the reflected spirit light of humanity, Anwar could discern the shapes of the material world, albeit dully, a psychic false colour rendering in blues and blacks. Behind this lurked the ever-present maelstrom of the warp. Not all telepaths had the dread cosmic truth in front of them all the time like Anwar did, but he had been luckier than others and had learned to mask its presence. Above it all was the light of the Astronomicon, a constant beacon that shone through the intervening rock of terror as if it were smoke, the bonfire of souls that bound the Imperium into one coherent entity. When he was younger, the undying blaze had kept him from sleeping. What it represented had terrified him. As he aged, it had become his greatest comfort. Only his own soul lit the way for him, the light of it coaxing meaning from the surrounding matter of his domicile. There were no servants to tend to him in the mornings anymore. As part of his penance, he had dismissed them. He half saw, half felt his way to his wash basin, where he plunged his face into freezing water. It filled his empty eye sockets, chilling his skull. The discomfort was good. He patted around for his towel and dried his face. Then he washed himself gaspingly and went to pray. The arcane patterns of hexagrammatic wards glimmered all around him, defining the corridors of the silent mansions. Through the murk of the solid walls behind the wards, he saw the distant glimmer of soul shine. Psychic humans were flaring beacons, the more mundane sort, still bright and glorious in their own way. Closer to his location, there were the dim, barely there flickers of servitors, slumbering in their alcoves. Anwar had heard it said that mind-wiping was no worse than execution. The people who said such things were wrong. The souls of the servitors were trapped in bodies of dead flesh and metal. It was a fate worse even than the ocean of souls that awaited the truly dead. His long staff talked as he made his way to the master's chapel. This room was the biggest in the mansions, full of artworks created with psychically active substances of immense cost that only the blind could see. Anwar went before the great statue of the Emperor Resplendent and knelt. By nature, Anwar was a spiritual man. His early life had been one of wonder, as a world no one else could see had opened to him. The black ships had taken that world away from him and given him another, more profound, when he had lost his sight in exchange for the touch of a god. That the Emperor was divine was beyond doubt. Anwar had seen him, a blazing soul that drowned all others with its light. The statues he had seen as a youth captured not the tiniest truth of his essence. For that one glimpse, Anwar felt himself truly blessed. He was content in all that he had done. He had served to the best of his ability and risen as far as any man of his station might go. He had a good friend in Sark. Sark was more powerful than Anwar, strong enough to keep his eyes. Sark had lived a full-blooded life before he took high office, Anwar one of monkish self-denial. But Anwar did not resent him. He was long past any sort of envy. He had been satisfied with the role the Emperor had chosen for him, and he worked diligently to fulfil that role when immersed in the madhouse of the Great Chamber. He had watched the ridiculous power struggles within the High Lords with a species of detached bewilderment, banding together with Sark and Gibran for no other reason than to preserve his sanity. He left politics to the others, taking pride in keeping his adeptus in order, and he had been content. He gave praise for his blessing, whispering mantras of thanks over and over. But he should have done more. He should have been more vigilant. For years, Anwar had been complacent. Lately, anguish replaced his contentment. He wondered in the dead of night if he could have foreseen the rise of the beast. The green roar had built slowly, giving all the appearance of being a simple disturbance in the warp, like so many in the past. The sort of storm that might last a night or a millennium, bearable nonetheless. But it had been different. He should have put resources into divining its source. Its true nature had become apparent only when the beast attacked, and then the bestial howling of the orcs had overwhelmed so many of his adepts. Communications had fallen into chaos. Now the warp was stilling again. The roaring of the orc had not disappeared, but receded into the distance like the thunder of a passing storm. Anwar was fearful. Like a storm, the beast could return again.
"I should have seen it coming, my lord. I swear I will next time," he whispered. "I will be more vigilant."
He pulled down his hood and unlaced the top of his robes. Anwar had ceased to wear the ornate garments of a high lord, reverting to the plain green astropath's garb. He pulled his skinny arms from the sleeves and pushed the robe down to his waist. He took up a switch made of rare birchwood grown in hallowed Arboreta. It was priceless, his sole remaining indulgence. This was his first penance.
"For failing in my duty, I beg your forgiveness," he murmured.
The crack of thin wood on flesh echoed off the chapel walls. Anwar suppressed a cry of pain.
"For failing in my duty, I beg your forgiveness."
He switched sides, whipping himself over the left shoulder. Every day, his back burning from his flagellation, he forced himself from the silent mansions to the astrotelepathicum of the Imperial Palace. There, he spent hours in the receiving couches, parsing messages from all over the Imperium. The majority of them were degraded by the turmoil in the warp. Disrupted chronologies were common. Anwar was gifted still. The passing of years had dulled his abilities little. He decoded more messages than the youngest and best, and he made himself do it. Story after story of ruination, horror, and savagery. This work was his second penance for his inaction. He prayed it would be enough to earn the Emperor's forgiveness. He knew in his heart it was not.
"For failing in my duty, I beg your forgiveness," he said louder,
his papery voice filling with power. He hit himself harder.
"For failing in my duty."
The gentlest scuff of a foot on dusty stone broke his chant. A blind man hears no better than a seeing man, but he does pay attention more closely to what his ears tell him.
"Who's there?"
he said, and turned. The nearest soul light was many rooms distant. There was nobody in the chapel with him. Still, he was compelled to shout out,
"This is the chapel of the Adeptus Astrotelepathica. Who is there?"
Silence. There was nobody there. There could be no one there without his seeing. Why, then, did the iron hand of dread squeeze his heart? He groped for his staff and stood, robes dangling around his waist. Sightless eyes panned around the room. Far greater senses than sight showed him nothing. The hexagrams and psychic paintings on the wall glowed, disapproving faces staring down. He froze. There was a disturbance in his second sight, a warping of a ward tapestry's silver threads. He drew in a frightened breath. The distortion moved, coming closer. As it approached, it became a sucking black void that drew all light towards it, banishing it utterly.
"Traitor,"
said a voice in a low whisper that pulled at the weft of Anwar's soul.
"No, wait! I am no traitor. I am a loyal servant of the Emperor,"
said Anwar. He stumbled backwards until his back connected painfully with the edge of the altar.
"We are the Emperor's justice. We are the Emperor's judgment."
A whirring rasp of machinery came, that of a metal iris opening. The whining rise of weaponry, spooling up to full power, vibrated Anwar's teeth painfully. There was only one being this could be. A Kalexus assassin. A creature like the Sisters of Silence, born without a soul, taken, trained, honed into a killer of psychers, an abomination which could extinguish the light of a soul as easily as snuffing a candle.
"I know your kind. Why did Vangarich not release you to fight the orcs? Why do you not show yourself now? You call me disloyal. What about the Grand Master?"
A darker point of light appeared in the air at head height, totally black, the absence of everything, space, time, and soul. Anwar felt his very being tugged towards it. The sensation was excruciating. Absolute terror flooded his aged heart.
"Please, please,"
he sobbed.
"I know. I know. I could have done more. I shall. I have learned my lesson. It is not enough to fulfill the Emperor's wishes. One must always strive to exceed them. I know this now,"
said Anwar. He slipped down the altar to kneel on the cold floor.
"Tell the Grand Master, I know I have been remiss. I am sorry. I am ashamed."
But his eyes could not cry, and no tears came.
"You are guilty,"
said the pariah. A beam of blackness cut across Anwar's spirit sight and connected with his forehead. For the first time in his life, he was truly blind. All good sensation was driven out of him, leaving nothing but the pain as his soul was pulled slowly from his body, singing like a raw, stretched nerve. With his mouth and with his mind, Anwar screamed. His last psychic shout blasted out from the chapel, stunning everyone it touched for 500 meters in every direction. His soul dissipated into nothing. The Kalexus shut off her anima speculum. Anwar's body fell to the ground, alive. But Abdulias Anwar had found a fate far worse than death. By the time his aides and guards reached the chapel, the Kalexus assassin had long gone. She had another psyker to visit that night. The Navigator's quarter was a world distinct from the rest of Terra. Though it was surrounded by the hives of standard humans, it was walled off from them absolutely. To be apart was the condition of the Navigators, on a starship or on the ground. Within the quarter's walls were the greatest palaces in the human galaxy, but no normal man might visit these gilded prisons for the Navis nobility. From his lighter, Helad Gibran looked glumly down over the soaring spires of the navigatorial estates, each house attempting to outdo the other with the height and splendor of its domain. Glittering pinnacles and gardens were cut through by broad waterways and lakes protected from the polluted air of Terra by ornate domes. Near the center was the greatest edifice of all, the Paternoval Palace, currently in possession of House Gibran. It was all so beautiful, so excessive, and so claustrophobic. The lighter pilot zeroed in on the main docking hall of the Paternoval Palace. Its outrageously decorated spires soared overhead, embracing Gibran in their shadows. He shuddered. Gibran was not pleased to be home. After they landed, he rushed through the ritual greeting offered him by House Gibran's servants in the hangar, and hurried to a Mecha Landau. He instructed its simple machine spirit to take him to his private quarters as quickly as possible.
"As you wish, Navigator,"
its unpleasant voice burbled. It lurched to its 6 feet and cantered off down the labyrinthine corridors of the palace, carrying in past lesser members of House Gibran about errands of their own. It was late, and he passed only one other of the mechanical transports. He returned the greeting of Lord Navis Otto Gibran as he approached, declined his offer to talk and take wine, and sped on. the landau deposited him in the entrance vestibule to his apartments, a high porch and steps set into a tall window of glass that looked out onto jungle gardens. Rain jetting in regimented bursts from sprinklers high in the artificial sky rattled on the window, an incongruously natural sound in those deeps of steel and stone. The moment he was through the door, his major domo, Edakian, came to greet him.
"You have been gone long, my lord," he said.
Edakian was a navigator like all in the quarter. His third eye was covered over with a strap marked with a sigil of House Gibran.
"I wish it were wandering through the stars, Edakian," said Helad Gibran. "I've wandered only so far as the Venusian Lagrange." "My lord," said Edakian, and dipped his head, "shall I order dinner prepared?"
Silent servants came to take Helad Gibran's outer garments, wash his hands and feet, and spray him with perfumes. Gibran put up with their ministrations impatiently.
"Yes, and call my companions. I wish to talk of other things than politics for a while." "There is a deal of work for you in your opusarium."
Gibran sighed with displeasure.
"I will look it over quickly. Dinner, 1 hour, I command it." "As you wish, my lord."
Gibran shook off the last of his servants and made for the large stairway curling around the glass-steel atrium of his apartments. Edakian followed him to the foot of the stairs.
"What of my lady Mossa Belasius, Gibran?"
"Schedule breakfast for us tomorrow. I shall see her then, not before."
"She was most insistent. She speak to you as soon as you arrive, my lord."
"Tomorrow, Edakian,"
Gibran called down from the balcony.
"I wish to look over the gardens for a while. Inform the Paternova's master of admissions that I have returned. If he will meet with me in the afternoon, then I am humbly at his disposal."
"My lord."
Gibran went into his opusarium and shut the door behind him. He rested against the smooth wood, closed his eyes, and let out a long, weary breath. The high lords he could handle, even the Paternova himself, but speaking to his wife tonight was one task too far. He stood. The lights were off. Soothing green light reflected off the jungle through the room's large rose window. On the far side of the room was a set of upholstered doors. Beyond them were his bed, his concubines, and his collection of fine off-world wines. He was in the mood to enjoy all three. First, he wished to look on his garden, a collection of ancient Terran plants which existed nowhere else. But to look over the garden, he must stand by his desk. His treacherous eyes were dragged to the piles of work atop it. It was a large desk, but not a scrap of its surface could be seen, buried under a pile of data slates, documents, and flimsies a meter high. His shoulders sagged. He looked to the exit. He could walk away and pretend he had not seen. He took a step forward, his hand reaching up involuntarily for the door and the pleasures beyond. He stopped. The stacks of work waited. His warp eye throbbed. He was a fool to come this way. Sentimental, wanting to look upon the gardens. There were no pure pleasures in this world that duty could not spoil.
"Warp, take it all," he said.
He pressed the button on his vox cuff.
"Edakian, I shall be late for dinner."
"Yes, your grace."
Gibran sat down with a heavy sigh. With a wave of his hand, he decreased the opacity of the window until it was totally clear. Artificial rain lashed against it, making the jungle foliage bob with its pounding. At least he might take some pleasure in that. The work was consuming. It never stopped. If it was not the business of the Imperium, it was the business of his house. He was not the Novator, but he was responsible for ratifying the breeding programs of his own closest relations. A good quarter of the documents concerned matches and marriage contracts. Many more were reports from Gibran navigators scattered across space by the war against the Beast. The saddest was the shortest, a list of known and probable losses for his and allied houses. He held the slate for far longer than it took to read it. The rain drummed hard on the window. On the other side of the dome encompassing the garden, Sol was slipping out of the smoggy sky. There was a knock at the door.
"Damn it! Edakian, Edakian, whoever that is, send him away!" Gibran bellowed. "I've got a stack of work here that stretches to Cypramundi and back. Edakian!"
Cursing, he put the slate back on the desk and swore as he chased his vox link around his wrist. When he pressed it, there was no answer to its musical chime.
Hedakion, where are you?
The door opened a crack, slashing the carpet with a spear of yellow lumen light from the landing.
Hedakion?
Gibran's hand strayed for the pistol under his desk. His fingers were brushing the holster when a familiar voice stayed his hand.
He is not here, cousin, said his visitor.
Dovrian Hofar, is that you?
He said with relief. He relaxed. It is I.
Why did you not announce yourself?
I was passing. I heard you'd come back and, you know, stopped by to surprise you.
Dovrian shrugged.
I rang and rang the bell, but Hedakion was nowhere to be found. I bring you refreshment where your lax servant has failed.
Gibran snapped on his desk lumen. Dovrian was Gibran's fifth cousin, three times removed, the product of three generations of marriage planning that had brought about a fruitful alliance between House Gibran and House Ofar. Careful breed matches meant his genetic code was predominantly that of House Ofar, and as such would have looked freakish to standard human eyes. Spindle-limbed and willowy tall, his skin had a bluish cast and an uncomfortable translucency that hinted at the squirmings of the muscles beneath. His third eye was bound with red cloth, as was House Ofar's custom. Discreet hydraulic calipers aided his movement, for the Ofars were void-adapted, forespread for service on rogue trader ships, ultra-light packet ships, and other far-ranging vessels. The Ofar palaces were in an orbital habitat around Jupiter, and they seldom ventured anywhere that had more than one-quarter Terran gravity, including the manned decks of the vessels they guided. Dovrian was reckoned of uncommon strength among his clan for the fact he could walk on Terra at all. It was this physical attribute that the Gibran blood had contributed, and as planned, it was also why he had been chosen as the Ofar ambassador to the court of the Paternova. The plan had been to create an Ofar who was of Gibran descent to support House Gibran in the Byzantine politics of the quarter, but good breeding only went so far in determining the traits of an individual navigator. In a society fond of high living and displays of wealth, Dovrian Ofar had a reputation as a rake, and so teetered alarmingly on the knife blade between asset and liability. He was, however, good company, and he knew his drink. In his hand he carried an octagonal bottle of European salt brandy, a particular favourite of Gibran's.
A gift to welcome you home.
I will not be staying long in the quarter, said Gibran. There is too much to do.
He waved his overlarge hand at the piles of documents on his desk.
I can see. Dovrian's exoskeleton hissed as he came closer. May I? Terra's pull is a burden on my limbs I haven't yet grown accustomed to.
Gibran nodded. Dovrian dragged over a chair and sat.
That is better. I miss the void.
Me also, and my yearnings grow deeper of late.
Gibran fetched two glasses and set them down in front of his cousin.
Come on, then, pour. When I do not complete this work, I can blame you.
Ah, I knew I had a use.
Dovrian uncorked the brandy and poured it. The sharp, briny smell of it prickled Gibran's taste buds.
To your health.
Dovrian raised his glass in salutation. Gibran drank. The brandy was fine, very fiery and salty. Dovrian put his own glass down untouched and topped up Gibran's glass.
Drink up, cousin. You never know which will be your last day. These have been testing times for us all.
Praise the Emperor to that,
said Gibran. He downed the brandy in one gulp and gasped appreciatively. A delightful tremor travelled up his spine from his stomach to his shoulders.
Any day these last months could have been your last, my last, the last day for everyone.
Dovrian gave a mirthless chuckle.
We came this close.
He held up his long mutant's fingers, thumb and forefinger, a hair's breadth apart. He smiled again, equally without humour.
You are not drinking, said Gibran.
No, I am not drinking.
He pushed the glass away from him with his long fingers.
Hellard, he said after a moment, the Paternova is displeased.
The glass paused at Gibran's lips.
How displeased! The delightful tremor did not stop, but increased, and turned painful. Gibran's shoulder shook. He set the glass down on the desk. His hands trembled so much he knocked it over. It fell with a muffled thud on the thick carpet, staining it with a sticky liquid.
You have poisoned me.
I have, said Dovrian.
But you cannot take my place.
I can, and I will. Lord Vangarich has made a pact with the Paternova. It is settled.
How? How did he speak with him without going through me? Gibran said.
700 years of life and decades of staring into the warp had rendered him immune to fear, so he thought. He had been wrong. Dovrian spread his hands apologetically.
I provided the conduit. It was a risk to me to even attempt it, but your performance has been so woeful, I was confident of success. The price for my ascension is your death. I am sorry. I am fond of you. It is nothing personal.
You traitor, you!
Gibran reached under his desk with weak hands for his pistol. The holster was empty, his throat constricted. He stood, his legs almost buckling.
Why?
He croaked.
Your strain is not even gravity-adapted. Living here will kill you.
You are gravity-adapted, but life here has still killed you.
Your every day will be agony.
Perhaps, but I am marooned here anyway. You made me suffer. Power will dull my pain.
Gibran spluttered and choked. He could barely breathe.
Edakian! Edakian!
His voice was a painful whisper. With the last of his strength, he stumbled drunkenly towards the doors, forcing them open by falling against them. He staggered out onto the balcony. It was empty. His servants had deserted him. Choking on frothing sputum that tasted of blood, Helard Gibran fell to the floor. Dovrian stood over him. Gibran tugged with nerveless fingers at his warp eye cover, hoping to reveal it and blast Dovrian with the fell energies it contained. But the scarf would not come loose, and his hand ceased to obey his brain. He slid to the floor, his limbs loose as string.
I am now the Paternoval envoy to the Senatorium Imperialis, said Dovrian, the youngest in all history. Can you imagine?
Gibran was past hearing. Dovrian stepped over his twitching corpse. A new world order was dawning. Joscina Tull sat limply in her bedchamber as her handmaid, Anaste, brushed her hair. She no longer took pleasure in the murals on her walls. Representing 4/5 of Imperial territory, they were huge spacescapes, the nebulae and planetary systems on them gleaming by cunning means, each celestial body shifting as the hours of the day passed to represent their position in the heavens relative to one another. Where perspective and positioning permitted, a view of the stars as they were seen from Terra. Fanciful beasts curled around the points of light, drawn from the dozens of zodiacs dreamed up across the ages. Humanity had always looked to the stars and dreamed, even in the worst of times. At night, when she lay in bed, the murals made it seem as if she floated through space. It had been a marvellous feeling. If she wished, she could call up the positions of Chartist ships in the areas depicted, so the murals served a purpose partway between art and strategic tool. She had always preferred them as art, spending long hours staring into abyssal depths, picking out the stars of the worlds she had visited. It was her meditation, her way of purging the cares of the day and focusing on what she was, the mistress of the free merchant fleets of the Imperium. Now, they gave her only shame. The dark between the pinpricks of distant suns held an unquenchable terror, and yet still she could not stop looking. Her nights were full of the screams of dying men and women crushed upon the Orc attack moon. She hadn't been on the surface, but she could imagine. During the day, her mind was troubled by flashes of bloodied faces and screaming orcs. She had been one of the lesser players of the great Imperial game, but an enthusiastic one. No more. Her mind was numbed with horror.
She stifled a sob. Anaste ran the brush through her hair.
Hush, mistress. Be still, be calm. We're nearly done. Am I hurting you?
Tull wanted to speak, but she was deep in sorrow. She shook her head mutely.
Put aside your cares, then.
Hiss, hiss, shush, shush, went the brush.
I have done such a terrible thing,
Tull said softly.
Hush, do not dwell on it.
I do not sleep.
Heavy are the burdens of power,
said Anaste. Tears welled up from Tull's eyes and spilled down her cheeks.
I failed in my responsibility. I overreached. I have embarrassed my adeptus and caused the loss of millions of lives. All so that the orc could laugh at us and that horrible face in orbit.
She buried her face in her hands and sobbed. Anaste set the brush down on the table and came around Tull's front. She grabbed Tull's wrists gently and pulled them away from her face. Anaste was very old.
Do not be sad. You have much to live for. You shall recover. You are strong and beautiful.
Tull smiled through her tears.
Not now.
You could be old like me. Better to stay beautiful forever.
That is impossible.
Then enjoy it now before it fades. In time you will be old and wrinkled as I.
Anaste gently pushed Tull around so that she faced the mirror above her dressing table.
See? Such fine hair. Not grey. Such perfect skin and bone structure.
Tull looked into the mirror. The contrast between the lady and her servant was striking. Horribly so. She imagined becoming that repulsive. The truth was that Tull was almost certainly many years older than Anaste, but antigerontic drugs and rejuvenate therapies could not stave off age forever.
My father was a remembrancer. Did you know that?
Said Anaste.
No, I didn't, said Tull.
He was very fond of ancient history, really ancient history, the cultures of Rome and Nihon from the first and second millennia. Do you know, in ancient times, when a warrior or official failed, they would kill themselves. They would take their gun or their sword, poison or a razor, and would end their lives just like that. They must have been very brave to do that, I always thought, to banish dishonour with their own sacrifice.
Yes, they must.
Her eyes strayed to a drawer in her table. Inside was her pistol, unworn for many years since she had left active service. The drawer was open a crack. She didn't remember taking out her gun. She had not for a long time.
My lady, said Anaste, putting her hands on Tull's shoulders, it is better to be strong, to face your failures and overcome them, to rise to the challenge that disgrace presents us and prove ourselves better.
But I am not strong, said Tull. I was, but I am not any more.
She put her hand over Anaste's. It was hot and soft.
Then you must be brave, said Anaste.
She squeezed Tull's hand.
I shall draw your bath, my lady.
Thank you, said Tull. You have always been a great comfort to me.
Anaste departed, leaving Tull alone below the shifting, hololithic skies. Thane, the Lord Gilliman, had accused her directly of incompetence. She had had faith in the Emperor. She had trusted he would aid her in her crusade. He had not. Mesring had had no faith either, and that had dismayed her. But Thane was no follower of the imperial creed. The Adeptus Astartes were gross deformations of the human form, but they were made by the Emperor himself. How stupid she had been. Thane was right. He was closer than she could ever be to the Emperor. Gods could not help them. Mankind should help itself. Where she had thought she had faith, she had exhibited a child's belief in the infallibility of her parents, nothing more. She looked at the drawer. She was naive, foolish. She had nothing more to offer. Perhaps she had enough strength left in her to be brave. The drawer slid out easily. Her pistol lay in a cavity fitted perfectly to its form. It was nothing exotic, a simple las pistol, but of great value to her. It had been a present from her father when she took command of her first ship. The gun was expensive, of course, chased with iridescent gold, etched with looping patterns. Her trembling fingers brushed it. Dishonor, that was the word Anaste had used. She pulled the gun from the drawer. The feel of its weight in her hand and the smoothness of the rosewood butt brought back memories. Most were good, proud memories. All they did was make the shame of the present seem sharper. She thumbed on the power. The battery indicator ticked up from red through to green. Funny. Her father always bought the best, but she would have thought the battery would have run flat during its time in the drawer. Many guilty lives had been claimed by the pistol. Mutinous crewmen, pirates, Xenos raiders. What was one more? The muzzle was cool on her temple. Anaste would not hear the shot over the thundering of the bathwater. Tull hoped someone else found her. The handmaid had been the closest thing she had to a friend. The stars shifted above. Once more, she took pleasure in their beauty. She smiled before she squeezed the trigger. A skull muffled the discharge. In the ablutorial down the hall, the bath ran and ran until it overtopped, spilling water and flower petals upon the floor. Anaste had returned to her temple, her mission complete. The Tower of Autumn was inconspicuous as the spires of Terra went. A bastion swallowed by the rebuilding of the city 1,000 years ago, it no longer served a defensive purpose. Being too hallowed to be given over to other uses, it remained as a dusty monument to the siege of the Imperial Palace. Very old Grimley looked up from its loopholes. Not far away was the Widdershins Tower and the Cerebrium at its summit.
"Come away from the window," said Lansung. "No one will see me. I don't like it. I don't like you staring up there. Vangarich has been using it as his personal lair, I hear. Skulking in there when he thinks no one is watching. He has been for some time. I bet it is crowded with listening devices and vid-capture units." "Probably. Certainly," said Veriold. "Does it matter? Did you ever use it?" "No. Mesring did, I think. Do I look so foolish?" "We have all been foolish to let that snake slither into our company," said Veriold. "He sat among us as if he were a member of the High 12 until he was actually made one. He's always been there, poking and prodding. Imagine if we'd have given Rosarind, Mendem, Hardiman, or any of the other lesser High Lords the same access." "We wouldn't," said Veriold.
The Cerebrium was featureless through the ever-present smog of terror. Faceless as an assassin, he thought.
"Abel, come away from the window, please," said Lansung.
Veriold sighed, but relented. He limped over to the table where Lansung sat. It was made of iron, circled by 9 seats, to represent the 9 loyalist primarchs of the Heresy War. None were designed to be sat in. They were oversized and bolted to the ground too close to the table. He lowered himself into one anyway, wincing as he bent his bad knee.
"Neither of us are getting any younger," said Veriold. "I should retire." "I'm more concerned with neither of us getting any older," said Lansung irritably. "Retiring won't save you from Vangarich's killers. In making him Lord Protector, Thane might as well have handed him a license for our executions." "Maybe. Don't maybe me, Abel. You wouldn't be here if you thought your head safe." "Perhaps. This is not the Senatorum. We have no room for equivocation. Stop the maybes and the perhapses. You must commit. Are you with me, or are you not?" "Yes, yes, of course I am."
Veriold gave his ally, friend was too much of a stretch for Lansung, a reassuring nod.
"Keep your head, man." "Damn it."
Lansung slapped his hand upon the table. It was an artisan's cap. Both of them were disguised as commoners, though they bore arms no common man could possibly possess. A cloud of dust rose to sparkle in the dirty sunlight.
"All this, all these years of service to be accused of treachery? What do the Adeptus Astartes know of governance? They are killers. It is all they know." "Where is Eckarth?" said Veriold. "Shouldn't he be here by now?"
Lansung pulled a pocket chronograph out.
"He is late. I advised him to take a circuitous route. He will have become lost. I've never seen him without 12 servants. The man's hopeless. Vangarich may have got to him already." "He'll be here," said Lansung.
They had nothing more to say. The raucous noise of Terra's traffic and industry rumbled in through the unglazed loopholes. The smell of their own fear settled in the room. The Autumn Tower had seen fierce fighting. Many heroes had been made there. Veriolt offered a private apology to their ghosts for his own cowardice. The door creaked. Lansung half leapt from his chair, his hand on the hilt of his sword. Veriolt drew his bolt pistol.
Ekarth?
The door squealed open. A breathless Ekarth smeared in rust and dust came through it.
Why are you dressed like that?
Said Lansung, eyes widening at the master of the Administratum's dirty finery. What if you are followed? Ekarth laughed through his panting at their disguises.
Do you think playing dress-up would help us?
Did you come alone?
Said Veriolt. He kept his bolt pistol in his hand.
I did. I got a little lost, said Ekarth. One is not used to arranging one's own affairs.
Sit. We lack for time, said Lansung.
I have guessed why you wish to see me.
Ekarth sat, equidistant from the other two, so they formed the points of a triangle.
Vangorich, said Veriolt,
his voice strangled on the name.
His appointment is dangerous, I agree, said Ekarth.
He forces our hand, said Lansung. Vangorich seeks to govern in all but name. He has threatened us to win our support. Our entourages were infiltrated. Assassins disguised as our closest bodyguards have been at our sides for the Emperor alone knows how long.
Months. Years, even, Lansung. We should not underestimate him, said Veriolt. We should not, said Ekarth.
He panicked.
Has he done the same to me? Are my family all right? I must go.
Calm down, Tobris. Stay seated. He will have similar plants in all the High Lord's houses.
Even Venans, even the Navigators, said Ekarth.
His eyes boggled. Sweat beaded his face.
Definitely. His men are everywhere, said Veriolt.
Are you sure?
We have seen it. Their faces melted and changed in front of us, said Lansung. Polymorphine. I saw it too, said Veriolt. He has used the threat of them to garner our support.
I had wondered why you voted with him recently, said Ekarth. What are you proposing?
Like any enemy, he must be destroyed, said Lansung. Killed, said Veriolt.
Assassinate the assassin? Are you sure? Said Ekarth.
We have no other choice, said Lansung. Our adepti have their own killers. Vangorich has no monopoly on death.
Ekarth's face changed in an instant, from panic to laughter. He opened his mouth wide and laughed so loudly the chamber rang with the sound of it.
He's gone insane, said Veriolt. I knew we should...
An overpowered las pistol went off, the displacement crack muffled by a megafuel modulator. Veriolt fell face forwards onto the table. As he died, his fingers tightened, sending a bolt shooting past Ekarth's head. It buried itself in the wall and exploded, scattering a spray of hot iron. Ekarth did not flinch at the impact. Lansung shrank in on himself, hands upraised. Ekarth stood, las pistol trained upon Lansung in a rock-steady grip, though a fragment of shrapnel hissed in the skin over his eye.
You are not Ekarth, said Lansung.
My, my! The people mutter about your idiocy. I had thought them wrong. It is the way of the ruled to rail against rulers. It appears they were not. Obviously, I am not Ekarth. Stand up.
The man who was not Ekarth jerked his gun.
Move! Take my place here.
And if I do not?
I'll shoot you and then drag you here. If you want to survive this, I advise you to comply. Move, Lord High Admiral.
This is treason. Vangorich cannot hope to get away with this.
Lansung stood up, his hands over his head.
I believe he can, though what I think doesn't matter. I am a tool. He is the artist. Now sit.
The assassin waved Lansung into the chair. Still covering the Lord High Admiral, he walked around the table, took up Veriolt's bolt pistol in his left hand, and crouched down to the level of the table. When he pointed the bolt pistol at Lansung, it was situated exactly where it would have been had Veriolt been alive and still holding it.
What are you doing? Said Lansung, his face blanching.
From your own lips you condemn yourselves. There is no escape from this. You are to die a traitor, Lord High Admiral.
Lansung rose from the chair.
You said I would survive.
I implied you would. Goodbye.
The assassin fired. Lansung's protests went unsaid. The bolt round hit him in the heart, obliterating the organ and with it the life. of Lord High Admiral Lansung. The assassin sprayed the guns with a geneticide that wiped all traces of his use of them away. He waited for the chemical agent to become inert, then placed the guns into the hands of the two dead High Lords. Then he peeled off the thin layers of flesh-coloured sinskin that covered his arms to the elbow, placed them in a loophole, and set them alight with a melter beam, burning them twice, so that only fine ash remained. He blew this away to join the rest of the particulate matter clogging Terra's skies. They'd find no Physalene discharge on him now, if they dared to look. He ruffled his hair, hyperventilated to redden his face, then keyed his vox button. Eckhart's servants waited for him at the foot of the tower.
"Help! Help!" he said in Eckhart's voice. "High Lords Lansung and Veriult have murdered each other!"